Byron Bay Writers Festival was on last weekend, and the star turn was American novelist, short story writer and screenwriter Bret Easton Ellis. He was here with his sixth novel, Imperial Bedrooms, which is the story of a group of characters from his first novel, the one published in 1985, called Less Than Zero. Generation X's saw it as the book that marked the lines around their generation, and it's often spoken of as their Catcher in the Rye. And between the publication of these books, Bret Easton Ellis's career has, in the words of critic Geordie Williamson, consisted of a series of increasingly remorseless acts of literary transgression, culminating in 1991's American Psycho, a work of such extravagant violence it came in sealed wrappers. And it still does. When preparing for this conversation, I read Bret's backlist, and here in Australia, American Psycho still arrives from the publishers R-certificated and cling-wrapped. And reading it on the plane on the way up to the festival, I hope that the bloke sitting next to me wasn't reading over my shoulder. It's a story narrated by Patrick Bateman, a yuppie serial killer, or maybe a yuppie who fantasises about killing, but nevertheless, lots of sex and violence and dismemberment and torture, told between accounts of designer clothes people are wearing and cool restaurants and clubs they're going to. Not everyone's cup of tea. And neither is its creator. When Guardian newspaper journalist Decca Aitkenhead spent a week following Ellis about, she was trying to get behind the real Bret Easton Ellis. She said, variously constructed as a hip literary brat packer, an enfant terrible, a drug-gobbling party boy, she asked, is he a misogynist, a monster, or a master satirist? Is he a genius? Is he a fraud? And she ended up by saying, I'm pretty sure he's one of the most disingenuous people I've ever met. At Byron Bay, in front of an unusually young audience of Ellis fans, I attempted to explore the mind behind the works, the master of alienated ennui, and you be the judge of how close I got. But first, we're going to hear an edited reading from Bret Easton Ellis's book Imperial Bedrooms, which starts with the narrator, Clay, recalling how the lives of his group of friends were used by a writer called Bret Easton Ellis for his book and the subsequent film Less Than Zero.
In the book, everything about me had happened. The book was something I simply couldn't disavow. The book was blunt and had an honesty about it, whereas the movie was just a beautiful lie. It was also a bummer, very colorful and busy, but also grim and expensive, and it didn't recoup its cost when released that November. In the movie, I was played by an actor who actually looked more like me than the character the author portrayed in the book. I wasn't blonde, I wasn't tan, and neither was the actor. I also suddenly became the movie's moral compass, spouting AA jargon, castigating everyone's drug use, and trying to save Julian. I'll sell my car, I warned the actor playing Julian's dealer, whatever it takes. This was slightly less true of the adaptation of Blair's character, played by a girl who actually seemed like she belonged in our group, jittery, sexually available, easily wounded. Julian became the sentimentalized version of himself, acted by a talented, sad-faced clown who has an affair with Blair and then realizes he has to let her go because I was his best bud. Be good to her, Julian tells Clay in the movie. She really deserves it. The sheer hypocrisy of this scene must have made the author blanch. But the thing I remember most about that screening in October 20 years ago was the moment Julian grasped my hand that had gone numb on the armrest separating our seats. He did this because in the book, Julian Wells lived, but in the movie's new scenario, he had to die. He had to be punished for all of his sins. That's what the movie demanded. Later, as a screenwriter, I learned it's what all movies demanded. When this scene occurred in the last 10 minutes, Julian looked at me in the darkness, stunned. I died, he whispered. They killed me off. I waited a beat before sighing, but you're still here. Julian turned back to the screen, and soon the movie ended, the credits rolling over the palm trees as I improbably take Blair back to my college while Roy Orbison wails a song about how life fades away. The real Julian Wells didn't die in a cherry red convertible overdosing on a highway in Joshua Tree while a choir soared over the soundtrack. The real Julian Wells was murdered over 20 years later, his body dumped behind an abandoned apartment building in Los Feliz after he had been tortured to death at another location. His head was crushed, his face struck with such force that it had partly folded in on itself, and he had been stabbed so brutally that the LA coroner's office counted 159 wounds from three different different knives, many of them overlapping. His body was discovered by a group of kids who went to CalArts and were cruising through the streets off of Hillhurst in a convertible BMW looking for a parking space. When they saw the body, they thought the thing laying by a trash bin was, and I'm quoting the first Los Angeles Times article on the front page of the California section about the Julian Wells murder, a flag. I had to stop when I hit upon that word and start reading the article again from the beginning. The students who found Julian thought this because Julian was wearing a white Tom Ford suit. It had belonged to him, but it wasn't something he was wearing the night he was abducted. And their immediate reaction seemed halfway logical, since the jacket and pants were streaked with red. Julian had been stripped before he was killed and then redressed. But if they thought it was a flag, my immediate question was, then where was the blue? If the body resembled a flag, I kept wondering, then where was the blue? And then I realized it was his head. The students thought it was a flag because Julian had lost so much blood that his crumpled face was a blue so dark it was almost black. But then I should have realized this sooner because, in my own way, I had put Julian there and I had seen what had happened to him in another and very different movie.
Thank you. Clay narrates this book as he did in Less Than Zero. It's 25 years since the group of people you wrote about have first come to our attention. How did you decide how they had changed, where they were at in their lives, how their values had changed?
Delta Goodrum. Delta Goodrum. Is that how you say her name? Delta
Goodrum?
So. Whoa. You have a very complicated relationship with this woman.
You have a complicated relationship.
I think you guys have one. I had no idea who she was. Absolutely no idea who this woman was. And when I flew into Brisbane, I was doing all these interviews, and I kept, what's it called, Music Max or something on the television in my hotel room, and I would take a break during the press stuff, and I would go up to my room, and I would watch, you know, videos would be on while I answered emails and returned phone calls. And this woman came on, and I thought, oh, my God, she's quite striking. I'd never seen her before. I had no idea who she was. And she was, you know, stomping around, tossing her hair back, singing about her life and how her persistence makes a difference. And she stumbled, and she fell, but now she's back on her feet. And she's like, you know, she's in one of the videos, she's like banging on a piano in the middle of a beach, and she's like writhing in the sand and talking about in this life, she just needs one love. And I kept thinking, God, she's really hot. And I really thought she was extremely attractive. And I, as I often do, and this video has been on a lot, and it was on here in Byron Bay as well. And before I went to bed last night, I decided to like tweet something about, what's her name? Delta Goodrum. And I did. I just tweeted something about Delta Goodrum. And then this morning, I woke up, and I had this fuselage of stuff on my Twitter account, and I had no idea who it was about at first, and one of them said, I have lost all faith in you as an author if you actually like this woman. And I said, who are these people talking about? And then I looked down, and I realized all of these responses were about this woman, Delta Goodrum. And I was thinking, my God, you've had a complicated reaction to this woman.
And this has got to do with what?
I don't know. I don't know. It's just been on my mind.
Do you want me to ask you another question?
No.
Didn't you like that question?
No, I did like that question, but I need to hear it again.
No, I think I didn't like your answer, so I'm going to ask you another one. This is what you've said about a lot of your work, that it's surprisingly conservative, that you are a moralist, that you are a satirist, that all of the fuss that's been made. And the Delta Goodrum story is another one, because you probably could have Googled the fact that she'd had cancer. And did you know that she had had cancer before you tweeted about her?
Nothing. I just thought she was very attractive, and yeah. I didn't really have any more interest other than that. And yeah. I just liked the song a little bit.
So nothing's changed with you in the 25 years?
No, nothing has. No, that's true.
Except Clay has changed, because he's gotten a lot older. And even though he's quite powerful now,
he's kind of in a powerful casting couch type position. He doesn't get that he's not that attractive anymore, and that the young actresses are really only keen on being anything to do with him if they can get a part in this Hollywood movie that he's writing. There's a kind of sadness about him, really, now. He says something like, how come she was such a bad actress on film and such a good actress in real life? Because he kind of knew that she really wasn't too keen on him, but she seemed to be having relationships with lots of people. But he seems to be slightly in love with her. He seems to not be so cynical as you might have thought.
The videos made in the 80s, they were doing this thing on Music Max today, they're really gay. They're really, really gay. All the Duran Duran videos and all the ones directed by Russell Mulcahy are just so homoerotic. I couldn't believe it. They were doing a thing on the making of all of these 80s videos and the stories behind them. And this was while I was waiting for another Delta Goodrem song to come on. And I was watching these, it's just, they were like, you look at these videos, either, whether it was Spandau Ballet or whether it was Duran Duran, or just can't believe that anyone would make videos this gay anymore. It was just really kind of astonishing, seeing them like dance around, waving their arms around, wearing like skirts, and I don't know, it bothered me a lot. It really did. Look,
maybe we're not as sophisticated as Hollywood for you.
No. That's what I like about Australia. That is what I have, that I realize I should have come here much sooner, is because I share the same kind of sensibility. And my friends in LA, who I think are the most fun, would come to Australia and tell me, you really have to go. You'd really like it. And I go, well, I don't really want to pay for the flight, and it's long, and I don't know anybody there. And so I kept saying this all the time. They said, no, the food's really good. The people are really hot. They like to drink a lot. They like to have sex, and they're all really good looking. And I was going, God, it sounds like paradise. It sounds really nice. But I'm not going to go because I can't go on my own, and I don't, you know. So then, you know, I got an invitation because of this book.
Why can't you go on your own?
You know what? I just didn't. It just seemed like a long trip, and maybe it wasn't going to be worth it. I don't know. You know, you can get a lot of those things in L.A. anyway. You don't really need to go to Australia, travel halfway around the world to get them.
Have you ever thought of doing stand-up?
No, I haven't ever thought of doing stand-up. I never do.
But this is
never,
like a stand-up routine.
I've never been in. I might be a bit nervous because I've never. This is the first appearance I've ever made in Australia. Mm. I mean, I've been writing for, you know, I've been publishing around the world for like 25 years, and I have never been to Australia. So it's a little nerve-wracking, and I'm just trying to break the ice a bit, I think. I mean, because I know you have serious questions, and I really want to answer them, but I'm just getting a feel for. I mean, I'm doing a lot of these things throughout Australia for the next 2 weeks, and I just kind of want to get.
Yeah, well, let me know when you're ready.
Okay, I will. But I've got some things on my mind. I'm thinking about things.
What's on your mind?
Well, you know, it was how gay the '80s videos were, and you know, of course, your complicated feelings about Delta Goodrem, and I'm kind of haunted by that. I don't know. Been gnawing at the back of my mind all day. It has. Who's laughing? So, all right. But I am, yes, so the reason I am here is because my publisher said, hey, we're going to invite you again. And I had two friends who just came back from a pretty debauched trip to Sydney, and they said, If you don't do this, you're like an idiot. You're a total fool not to take advantage of the fact that you can go to Australia and all expenses are paid. And, you know, you do have to do a book tour, which is, you know, part of the bargain. And so, voila. That's why I'm here. But, yes, I know. I have to talk about a book that I wrote a very long time ago. And it's like hard to, you know.
This one you didn't write a long time ago.
I finished this book for like 14 months ago, 15 months ago.
Is that a long time in Brit Easton Ellis land?
How do I answer a question like that? I don't know. I guess it is. I guess it is a bit of a long time. It's a long time between the finishing of the completion of a novel and then having to come out and kind of talk about it. And I find the disconnect about this whole thing in a way is, and I'm always reminded about it, is that my relationship to the novel is very, very different from a reader's. I mean, I lived with this book for I mean, I first thought about writing this book 8 years ago, and I've been thinking about it, you know, having this internal dialogue in my head about who Clay is and what's he doing now. And this went throughout the writing of Lunar Park, because I first got the idea to write this book when I reread Less Than Zero for the first time since its publication, because I wanted to refamiliarize myself with the narrator of Lunar Park, who is Bret Easton Ellis. And so I read all of his books, and the one thing that I took from Less Than Zero was, like, I wanted to know where this he was now. I wanted to know where that 19-year-old was. And so, you know, so it's very personal, and a lot of other things are going on in my life that, you know, encourage me to write the book. And then the book starts announcing itself to me, and I make notes, and I'm writing the book, and it's not practical, it's not logical. I'm not thinking about, oh, I have to do this or I have to do that. It's just like emotion. It's pure emotion. And then the technician comes in near the end and tightens things up and turns it into the book that I want to read, because I'm not writing this for anybody. I'm not writing it. I'm sorry, guys. I'm not writing this book for a reader. I'm writing this for myself. I'm the reader for this book. And then 16 months go by and the book is out, and then you go out on tour, because that is really what you do for your publishing house. And it's like, oh, right, the why questions, why this, why that. And it's fine. It's fine. But I really find that I don't have, like, answers to it, in a way. I just don't have answers to it. I'm feeling a little bit better now, and I can truly focus on the questions, and I'm okay. I am okay now, but it just took a little bit.
Do you want
bit
some
of,
water? There's some water here.
I do want some water,
it's
yes.
It's just here, just over this side. See? Just there.
Can the person who adjusted the mic hand me the glass?
We don't have slaves in Australia. Did they not tell you? Thing about Lunar Park, you've got Bret Easton Ellis as a character.
Yes.
And he has written American Psycho, and he's written all kinds of things that you have written, and he has a very different life to you, I think, probably. And it's not the first time writers put themselves in novels. Philip Roth has done it. It's an interesting thing to do. It confuses us about how we're supposed to. Is he telling us that this is not him? Is he telling us that Bret Easton Ellis is a character? Is he telling us that you are doing a Bret Easton Ellis impression now because that's what you do on a book tour? I'm not going to say why something is. Because you don't like why questions. But it does raise all kinds of mixed ideas in the reader's head. How do we really know?
Hold on. Getting out of control here. No, it's just a book. No, please. You shouldn't get that lost.
You shouldn't get that serious
about
it.
This isn't Inception or something. This isn't like a dream within a dream.
There are layers here.
It's a bit of a puzzle, but it's not, you know, it's not that, you know, please, you're worrying me. I'm getting worried about how it's,
You don't want me to take you seriously then?
Well, you know, you can take me seriously. I mean, you know, some people do. Many people don't.
You don't, do you? You don't take yourself seriously.
It's hard to in this kind of venue. It is. It is hard to take, because it is. You want to be authentic. You want to be real. And the real me really wants to talk about Delta Goodrum, you know?
I think she's too young for you.
Who is she dating now? It's interesting. I don't know. I might be very well too old for Delta. I don't know. But it's interesting that you pointed that out, and you also pointed out that Clay was
Read your books very, very carefully. So you point out that Clay is very...
No, you just said that Clay was not as attractive as he might have been to these girls, and that's certainly not the case in Hollywood. I mean, guys like Clay are very attractive to these girls. And
for the same reason as this girl is attracted to Clay, because she wants to get a part.
Well, yes, this is a novel. It is a made-up scenario.
So in Hollywood, it's much more runs on love, does it?
No, it doesn't run on love, but the casting couch is the fun part of Hollywood. The casting couch is fun. Clay turns it into a nightmarish drama because he's a total narcissist. I mean, that's one of the best parts about Hollywood is people exchanging sex for favors. I mean, that's how it is. That's fun. Everyone gets what they're doing. It's not like a big problem. I mean, the problem in Hollywood is that uncreative people are in charge of creative decisions. That's a real nightmare of Hollywood. But that's not a particularly interesting novel, and that's not a particularly sexy story, and it doesn't interest me as a dramatist, and it really wasn't what I wanted to explore in a novel. But no, Casting Couch is fun.
It's very different from the New York literary life, the L.A. Hollywood life.
New York literary life. I get chills when I think of what the New York literary life is.
But you were in it for a long time.
I was a poser. I posed during that whole thing. I was scared. I didn't know how else to act. I was supposed to be like this, whatever, this serious young American novelist, and I was groomed for this position that I was not in any way,
shape, or form. Who groomed you?
Well, the press, at first when Lesson Zero came out, I was supposed to be the standard bearer for this new generation of fiction that was about to come out. I was 21. I was going to be the leader of this thing. Didn't want to be the leader of anything, and I also didn't even think that book was going to be published, let alone read by as many people as ultimately read it. And so I just wanted to just party and go out to clubs and stuff, and I did. And much to the chagrin of the gatekeepers and the literary community and the people who wrote about books and who wrote about authors. And I got slagged really heavily for just being 23. And I like to write. Sure, I like to write on the side. But I didn't want to, deliver, speeches at Penn dinners or go to, write long essays for the New York Times Book Review. It was just not the kind of person I was. And so I did feel I felt like an outsider all the years that I was living in New York. I did have a lot of friends there. I did write a couple of novels while I was there. And I had a good run. I mean, it was fun. It was very fun. But I always felt like a little bit of an outsider. I never felt, I didn't write critical essays. I really wasn't big on any kind of literary committees. I had friends who were writers, so I dutifully went to book parties and to book dinners. Many friends who were editors, just by the very nature of whatever my life was like. But ultimately, I never felt that I really fit in. I never felt I was smart enough to fit in. And in L.A., I feel very smart. I do. I moved back there 4 years ago, and I can't believe what a boost to my self-esteem it was. I'm in L.A., I'm brilliant. I can't believe it. In New York, not so much.
I am really interested in this idea of all the attacks that you have had over your writing life about the violence that you write about and the sort of repeated in-your-face violence and the kind of cool way that you describe, a terribly violent episode, and then somebody will be going to a restaurant and ordering a meal or commenting on what they're wearing or whatever, And you've said before that you were surprised at the response, that you are a satirist. I think once you said, you were taking a moral position, and that's, why you were satirising this society you found yourself in. And I was thinking, well, does that imply that you have a moral position that, you would like to see in the place of all this stuff that you're satirising? And what is it? I mean, what kind of world are you hoping for? That's an easy question.
There was eight questions in that question. No, I don't even know where to begin.
I was leading you up to the question. I was taking your hand and leading you to the question.
Yeah, I know you were. I know. Okay. So the idea of juxtaposing very violent acts.
You're a satirist. You're a good writer. You write all this stuff about the madness of the societies you find yourself in, whether it's New York or L.A.
Right.
And you just sort of rev it up to higher and higher madnesses.
Yes, this
is
true.
So what are we saying here? Are you saying that, look, these people shouldn't be on Wall Street, shouldn't be making crap movies in Hollywood? We should be doing something else with the world we've got. Is that what you're saying as a moralist? Because otherwise you're not a moralist.
No, I'm not. I'm not any of those things. I'm not any of those things at all. The books are about me. They all start from my pain. Mm. They all start from a very, very personal place. They're emotionally... The genesis is emotional. I do not sit up one morning and say, okay, I am a satirist, therefore a moralist, and I am going to take down the men who run Wall Street. Okay, I'll begin Monday morning at 9 a.m. Doesn't work that way. It works how it works is I moved to New York and I'm about to write a third novel. And yes, I do want it to be about young people in New York and the Wall Street era, but I'm also overwhelmed by my loneliness, my alienation, my rage at having to become an adult finally, because I was 23 when I started writing American Psycho. And I thought the values of that society and that world were disgusting. And I was enraged that I had to become a part of it, that I had to become a man. And I was living the life of Patrick Bateman. I was his same age. I went to the same clubs. I went to the same restaurants. I wore the same suits. I had a bit of money for my books. So I was living that yuppie lifestyle and thinking, oh, well, this is going to fill up the void that I'm feeling right now. And it's going to, like, soothe the anger and rage I have about becoming an adult and having to become an adult. That's where American Psycho started. And then but that isn't that interesting to me. Writing about myself in an autobiographical way isn't that interesting to me. And so then Patrick Bateman starts to become this creation based on whatever that emotional journey, I guess, I hate that term, but whatever, that I was going on at the time. I start to build a character from that. And who is an expression of all the things that I was going through at the time, and that happened to be Patrick Bateman. But I was very defensive about that novel when it came out because of the controversy that it caused. And so I did make statements to protect myself and to protect what I thought was the reputation of the book as, oh, it's a sweeping indictment of Wall Street. Oh, yes, it is a sweeping indictment of yuppie culture. I am condemning all of this. And yes, I'm a very, very fervent satirist and moralist, and I would never, ever write a book that revels in whatever it purports to denounce. Oh, yes, I would. Oh, I would, because I think that's fun, and I liked writing that, and I liked pushing sex up against violence, and I liked writing about these long scenes that went on. I liked writing essentially a 400-page plotless novel. Can I do it? Ooh, this will be interesting to see if I can do it. Oh, also, he's like kind of crazy, and he details everything he does in mind-numbing order, and I'm not going to cut it out. I'm going to keep it in. And so, yes, it's playful. It's emotional-based. It's not. I do not feel that I am stepping forward into the spotlight with my hands on my hips going, I am going to tell you guys that this is the way the world is, and it's terrible. And I'm smarter than all of you anyway, and that's what I'm delivering messages. I'm an oracle. No, it doesn't happen that way. And I am very amused to a degree that the books that I am taking that seriously at times. Now, yes, you can look at American Psycho as that. Of course, you can look at Lesson Zero as a condemnation of that generation of youth or of youth culture at that particular period in time. Was that why I wrote the books? No, I wrote the books for very, very personal reasons. And that's how I've written every single book. They start from a very personal place and often a place of pain and confusion. And so, the book is a way to alleviate myself from
that. So not a moralist, but
accidentally.
But an anaesthetist, perhaps?
Perhaps. An anaesthetist. An
anaesthetizing.
I don't want to be...
Not just your own pain, but people's view about violence and people's revulsion.
I think violence is it's something I'm drawn to in my work. I don't know why. I mean, it's just something that's usually, depending on what I'm writing about, seems to me to be a very effective thing to do.
Somehow you've painted yourself into a corner with the such visceral stuff in American Psycho, but also this, you've read the little bit at the beginning and there is other stuff in it as well. It's so extreme. Where else can you go?
No, I don't look at myself that way. I don't look at writing that way. I don't look at creating a book that way, that I've painted myself into a corner. I just write the books that I want to write, and regardless of how they turn out, they're a reflection of where I was at a certain point in my life. I don't rate the books against each other. I don't think I have to outdo American Psycho. I don't think that, people are worried that Imperial Bedrooms is in a way a betrayal of Lesson Zero because it rewrites something that people feel a bit sentimental about. They like Lesson Zero a lot. They want Clay to be a better person than he ends up being, et cetera, et cetera. I cannot take any of that into account as a writer. I don't. I mean, I write books because I am feeling them at the time. And that's simply it. And I kind of don't look at it that way, like painting myself into a corner. I mean, it's a fair question, but honestly, I don't know what that means in terms of how it applies to me.
Brett Easton Ellis with me, Ramona Koval, at the Byron Bay Writers Festival. And his latest book is called Imperial Bedrooms. It's published by Picador. This is The Book Show. You're on ABC Radio National.